conventional truth and absolute truth. When we talk about the world or things or people, it's true because this is conventional truth. Everyone can understand what we are talking about. But the absolute truth, even you don't mention or call or say anything, it's there. Anyone can experience, like seeing. A dog can see, a cat can see, human being can see, because seeing performs its function of seeing when there are conditions for seeing to arise and experience visible object. While one is asleep, there is no seeing because no condition yet for seeing to arise or for hearing to arise. So it depends on conditions for each moment to arise. That is what we understand, that reality is not self, it's uncontrollable, and it is conditioned, so it can arise.
But when you say that the truth mm-hmm. must be proven,
yes,
the absolute truth
right.
must be proven, how would we go about doing that?
Yes, like last night question, yeah. In order to prove, we have to understand more about absolute realities. For example, nobody has doubt about seeing and visible object. But what are they? See, it's not just simple seeing and visible object. The difference of these two characteristics, one can experience, the other cannot experience. So no matter we live in this world or other world or on the moon or anywhere else, there must be seeing. Right? Even there, up there on the moon, if one can go there, there is seeing to experience what one takes for the moon.
For us, there would be seeing.
But,
wherever we went, there would be
yes,
seeing.
Yes, and what about birds and cats?
Yes, but take an insect, for instance. An insect is different from us.
You mean that some insects do not have eye sense?
Yes,
mm-hmm.
but...
Like some human being who are blind.
Yes, but what we mm-hmm. see... Okay, now I'm going off. What we see is just what we are equipped to... what we see is conditioned by the faculties given to us. It's limited by the faculties. Now,
for example, a dog can hear a different range of sound.
Yes.
But the experiencing of the sound is the same.
Yes. But it's just... the reality experienced by an insect, a dog, or a human being, given the same conditions, say, sitting in this room and watching a view or talking, must be different.
But that is beyond visible object. Because visible object at the moment when it experienced, it is experienced only by a moment of consciousness which sees. There is no thinking about dimension or concept or shape or form yet. It's after, like hearing now. It seems like we understand instantly what we hear, but actually there must be a moment of hearing first. Because sounds are different, right? Some is low and some is high. And by memory, remembering the shade of different sounds, it brings about the idea of what is heard. So that's why baby learns to listen and then remember and then get meaning. So there must be actual moment of hearing, not understanding the meaning of the sound yet. And later on, the other moments get the idea of what is heard very fast. The succession of the different moments.
So you're saying the different stages, you must start with hearing. And then you start to communicate. And then you start to understand.
Yeah.
In the same. I question that whether or not it's necessarily... Hearing is the first stage. Like, I mean, a mother teaching a child, and you say to them, you must do this. And then you communicate to him or her enough, then he starts to understand and he starts to progress and to another stage. To, if you say, you could use the word to see the way as such.
And what about seeing?
No, but what I'm saying is, hearing is your first, by what I can understand what you're saying is, so hearing is the first stage of communicating to, let's say, all of us here. Then the second stage would possibly be talking, maybe. Because once you have listened enough, then you start to understand a little bit better. Because, I mean, you can only communicate if you understand the subject, right? Then you talk about it enough, then you take some action, I suppose, to get you to another stage of understanding.
You mean that one can learn more by hearing, right? Because just seeing is not enough. We need hearing too.
Yeah. Or what I'm saying, to support what you're saying is, or to understand what you're saying is, that your view is hearing is the first stage of understanding.
I think what she's saying is that what we take for hearing is several stages. Mm. First there is the sound is experienced, and then the meaning of the sound is understood, being a process subsequent to the actual hearing. So I think it's hearing is the first in what we take as being hear. What we take to be hearing is several stages, the first of which is actually hearing, and then the subsequent ones being the understanding or giving the meaning to what is heard.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose by analogy, similar in the case of the other sense doors, for seeing, there is the experience of the visible object, let's call it that, for want of a better word. But it's thinking about that which gives meaning to what is seen. And perhaps that's where Jan's point comes in, that even if we all see the same thing, by nature of our past experiences, we perceive it differently.
Inevitably. We all. And so both are the conventional reality and also our perception of an absolute reality must be different from each one of us, for each one of us.
The perception of... But is the absolute reality different for each of us, or is...
Well, it's just, this is what interests me, this question of why it has to be proven. Because why does it have to be proven? That is it... Once we experience it, presumably we will just instantly recognize it as being absolute.
Yes.
Each dependent on our own perception and dependent on our own...
But when we use the term, it can be proven, it's like a question whether we understand it correctly, perfectly, or not. For example, when we talk about visible object, it seems like we understand that now visible object appears, but do we really take visible object as visible object, not anything, not someone, not something, now? So by understanding that visible object has to be just visible object, it needs more understanding, because it has to eliminate the idea of things or people from visible object which appears. To really understand that visible object cannot be anything. It can be seen. That's all. Mm-hmm. When one closes one's eyes, there is nobody here. There is only one color or few or some colors, right? Closing one's eyes. No idea of people and things. But as soon as one opens one's eyes with different colors, it brings different ideas of different shape and form. So one knows that if it's pure visible object, it is a reality, just a reality that cannot be taken for anything because it can be just seen. This is the idea to understand the world or what life is from moment to moment in a day. To understand that actually nothing stays, even this moment, it passed away unknowingly so fast. So the idea of self or I is just thinking or taking realities that we do not really understand them as I all the time. When we were born, there is the idea that we were baby and then grown up, but where were those rupas or materiality, corporeality, visible object or things like that? It passed away. This is why one gets old and gets sick and then die, because nothing can stay. Nobody who was born will not die. Everyone has to pass away, because even now it's passed away unknowingly. So we can say that this is momentarily death of everything.
You could also turn around and say it's momentarily birth of it.
Okay. Of the next moment.
Of the next moment.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we are not afraid of death.
It's a continuous creation.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Because, but we don't know the plane of existence that one would be reborn, because we see dogs and cats and animal kingdom, and we don't know what kind of conditions to condition just that moment of rebirth consciousness. If one believes in cause and effect, the good cause will bring good result, and the unwholesome cause will bring unwholesome or unpleasant result. It can help one to see and develop more understanding, because without understanding, even we would like to be the better one. It depends on accumulation, because we still do have aversion and all defilements, attachment, stinginess, laziness. But when there is more understanding, it's like you said last night, wearing glass with you can see clearer, understand reality better. When there is no self, you can help people better. You will not be as selfish or take things for your own. You will let go and give away easily, and you can help the others happily, pleasantly, because people are the same. They would like to have pleasant feelings, that's all, in one's life, just wanting for the pleasant feeling, which is not permanent, but still they just want it because it's pleasant. Nobody would like to experience the unpleasant moments, but there are conditions for unpleasant moment, because that moment is conditioned by cause. So if one understands in one's life what moments are the causes and what moments are the effects, one knows that this moment is the wholesome cause, and it will bring about the wholesome or pleasant effects later. That's why we don't do unpleasant things to the others or harmful things, because when one thinks that it harms the other, it harms oneself first. It's unwholesome. So it's like collecting the garbage or the unpleasant things.
Excuse me, taking your point, what you just said, like seeing things clearer, I mean, you need a pair of glasses. Does that mean seeing, going by the analogies, maybe, you know, if you're seeing things clearer and seeking truth as such, you need help, outside help, outside instrument?
I think that what we mean is developing understanding, because it depends on accumulation. If one wants to be generous, it can start now and then accumulate little by little. So if one would like to understand this moment, the reality of this moment, there is only one way, developing understanding of what appears now. At moment of hearing, there can be understanding of hearing, which is different from sound. And at this moment of seeing, there can be important. Because actually, each reality is conditioned, uncontrollable. What you take for myself, you cannot control it. Even thinking, even feeling, even the change of the body.
So are you left with nothing at the end of the day?
Understanding is not nothing. Understanding is not nothing. Nothing cannot understand anything, right?
Or you either understand a lot. So going back to the zero base, in a sense, you fully understand that situation to become that you're so, sorry, how do I say that? You understand it so much that you become non-understanding. Or you, sorry, I'm confused. So I'm not saying
what I was going to say about it, it strikes me as that one would have a tremendous sense of freedom because that pure understanding of this very moment casts away, I mean, I was brought up a Catholic, it reminds me a little bit. It reminds me a little bit of the French existentialist idea. Once you cast away all this idea of working for the next life and the hereafter and so on, you're really concentrating on this very moment. So many of us live with thoughts of the past and of the future. Mm-hmm. If you train your mind this way, you're living for this very moment so that you can fully concentrate on this very moment of existence. And I think it must make for a very pure existence and a very... to me, it seems a sense of freedom from a lot of the baggage we carry around with us that perhaps some of the more conventional religions have taught. I don't know. It's just some of the things I'm thinking of at the moment. It strikes me that concentration is very moment. You're not left with nothing. You're left with a great deal, I think. You're left with an enormous sense of consciousness, the understanding.
I take it as a spiritual freedom, or a full understanding of yourself. Because I mean, if you understand yourself fully, then this is really, you have achieved a certain stage, haven't you? I mean, we often try to understand ourselves constantly, and it's not easy because we've been bombarded by whatever is happening outside, and you're influenced by it, or your mood tend to fluctuate by it. I mean, if there is something on TV, it shows violence, and your mood starts to change. But I think the moment you can control and understand what's happening outside, then you almost achieve a certain degree of peacefulness, I think. But I was going to ask you something, please. That you mentioned the sixth sense.
Yes.
Is there any way to improve or increase that sensitivity?
I think that one way, there is one way, that developing understanding. Because what one considered the best in one's life, wealth, health, or right understanding, or wisdom.
So understanding by that, could you extend it a little bit more? You understand around you, you understand nature, you at one with anything and everything.
We use the word right understanding, so there must be wrong understanding, different natures, right? Right understanding is the understanding of reality which appears as it is, not as something. For example, visible object is visible object. When there is understanding of visible object of just a moment which is conditioned, so it arises, otherwise it cannot be experienced by understanding it as no body, no thing in it. That is right understanding of visible object. It takes time to develop, but it's true. Like sound, it arises so it can be heard, right? And then it falls away so fast, and it conditions hearing without sound attack, and ear sense, there cannot be hearing at all. At moment of touching something, you may think that it has been there for quite a long time, but at the actual moment of touching, it arises. So it's there, and then it falls away. This is the understanding of the impermanence of everything. No matter it's mental reality or corporeality reality. It sounds like theory, but it can be proven. See, this is what I said, that it should be proven. To have firm and stable understanding, not just whether, oh, it's like that, but how can it be experienced? Is it possible? Is there anywhere? Because one now knows that nothing's there, like hearing and seeing and sound and smell and everything, but should be developed higher understanding that we can be truly believe that it's like that, that is right understanding. We use lots of terms, but we don't understand the realities of those terms. For example, ignorance. We use a lot, right? Wisdom. But what is the real nature of ignorance? And what is the characteristic of right understanding? Because any reality has its characteristic and function, manifestation and proximate cause too for its arising. So precise when there is right understanding of reality, of each reality.
This is what I have great difficulty to understand, because since we all perceive the world in different ways, then we must also have, which is based on a conditioned process, our own personal experiences, how we were brought up, where we were brought up, where our mother and fathers were, and so on and so on, and our own faculties given at birth. So, therefore, inevitably our experience, or our, as we sit here now, each one of us must have a different experience of what's going on.
But we do see the same thing.
We all see the same thing.
Yeah.
But if I understand you correctly, with insight, all given these our different backgrounds and different faculties, we would all, with insight, experience the absolute in exactly the same way.
When we talk about absolute realities, we do not think in terms of people at all.
No.
So there are two kinds of absolute realities. Just two first, and then we go on. The first, or one, is the reality that can experience an object. It sees, it hears, it thinks. Right? It feels, it remembers, it likes, it dislikes. These are mentality or the reality that can experience an object. And the other reality is the reality that cannot experience anything at all. No matter in this universe or other universe, there are only two main characteristics of reality. One can experience an object and the other cannot experience. That's why now we take the experiencing as human being with different names and thoughts, and this cannot experience anything at all.
You were talking about impermanence, which is of course one of the, if I had to use one term to categorize Buddhism, its notion of impermanence. Does this notion of impermanence become especially important in this, in the thinking about the only issue that matters to all of us as human beings, and that is the reality of death, the notion of that each bodily moment, each day, is impermanent and
in purest Buddhist theory, that it has gone before we even know about it, and that death is merely another state after our last state of impermanence, and that we are the same in Buddhist theory, as I understand. We are the same person in death as we were in life, just as an older person and a baby is an old man, an old person, and a baby are the same person at the different stage of life, and that death is merely, if you will, an extension, another impermanence. And is this a proper understanding of the Buddhist idea of death as an using the concept of impermanence?
There are three kinds of death. The temporarily death, which means the arising and falling away of reality in split seconds, like the arising of seeing and the falling away of seeing, and the arising of hearing and the falling away of hearing. This is temporarily death, because what has risen and fallen away is completely gone, never come back.
But we have memory of it. And in that sense, that death, I understand as a poet, I understand full well what you mean by death, in quotes. I mean, it has gone, it has fallen, but there's still memory of the seeing and
right.
Hearing.
Yeah.
And again, I don't mean to interrupt, but the death that, of course, I'm referring to is the death with a capital T-H-E-D-E-T-H,
yeah.
Where for most of us, at least for me, what makes it so awesome is the fact that there's no memory, as I can, in my judgment, after I go, and that there is no world without me, as I judge it. That is to say that there is simply nothing near. You know, Vana is this marvelous concept of all in all and nothing in nothing and essentially indefinable. But is this theory of impermanence, again, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but you mentioned that form of death, and certainly poetically, the rising and falling, the sound, hearing, speech.
Or the passing away.
The passing away, or the rising and the falling. It's gone. I have spoken, and that's gone. Those words, except if Jonathan is recording them. This is quite funny.
May come back to haunt you.
Yes. That's why I'm so careful in class what I say with my students. They remember everything. They have perfect Chinese memories. But that is certainly a form of, if you will, of death.
Now I have doubt about the term I use. Whether it's the correct one, the arising and falling away, or the arising and passing away. Which one is the same?
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that up and down at all. It means just appear and disappear, right?
Well, okay. Poetically, I can accept either one.
Mm-hmm. Even in Thai word, when I use the term arising, they think it like this, and falling away, it's like this. But actually, it's just, I don't know, appear or becoming, and then
disappear.
Yeah. And even memory cannot stay.
It all depends. My parents are 93 and have absolutely, they knock on wood. They have never actually forgotten anything, like the Bourbons. In France, they remember nothing. They remember nothing, and they've forgotten nothing. So, in that sense, I mean, again, quite literally, I think memory can be extremely permanent, amazingly permanent.
At moment of seeing, is there any memory of the object which is seen? And at moment of hearing, is there any memory of what is heard? They are different. They are different. So even memory cannot stay. Memory also is not permanent.
It may be actually mutable, but in a sense it is permanent. I mean, I don't mean to be argumentative. Certainly, the memory, we have what we call in consumer behavior, obviously, a selective memory. We remember that which we choose to remember. you know, and even things we choose to remember, we may remember a little differently than they were. But it seems to me some form of that always remains, but perhaps not.
Is seeing now permanent?
Sorry?
Is seeing?
Seeing?
Now permanent?
Well, till I go blind, yes. I mean, I see, and I look at this view every day from our bedroom window. Yes, it's permanent. In that sense, permanent till I die. Till I lose my sight.
Yeah, and what about hearing? Is it permanent?
If we remember it, I remember the opening notes of music, yes. I mean, in a sense, it's permanent. I can reproduce it in my mind. I mean, in that
I
sense.
I mean, the actual hearing. The actual hearing now, is it permanent?
No, it's gone. It's in the air. Well, the words are in the air and are gone.
You mean the experiencing? The experiencing cannot stay either.
No. Experiencing for that moment, but it can be reproduced.
The next
it's always
one.
Different. It's always different each time I hear a symphony, clearly, because I'm a different person, even though I hear it twice a day.
So the next moment of experiencing is not the same as the previous one?
Of course not, mm-hmm. Sure.
Yeah. And that is meant by temporarily death. And we also have another death, another kind of death, which you use the quotation, the chapter one, the conventional death.
Convention.
Mm-hmm. Because it cannot stop there as long as there are conditions to produce the next moment. And we use the term rebirth after death. And we also do have final death for the person who does not have defilements or conditions for the arising of the next moment after death.
You're saying is getting off that wheel of reincarnation.
Right,
the Buddhist
right.
symbol, of course, the wheel.
Right.
And the object in Hinduism and Buddhism both. Buddhism, of course, having grown out of Hinduism, is to essentially get off that wheel in one way or another. Whether the Atman and the Brahman merges in Hinduism or we deny it, you would deny it. In Buddhism, the Atman, the Brahman, the individual soul, and just speak about the Atman. The great world soul, that merging, that's certainly true. But what bothers perhaps a Cartesian rationalist is the fact that obviously no one has ever come back from the other side. I should say obviously in my mind. And this thought of a world without me is very, very selfish. Very selfish. It's a horrifying thought. Because unless I am here and
yes.
In sentient, there's no world. And this is a very, very, very terrifying thing.
When there is the idea of self or the clinging to the I,
yeah.
It's so frightening.
It is.
But when it's understanding at that moment, it cannot be frightened because of understanding, which is very well established. Understanding this moment, whether it's seeing or hearing or thinking.
But how does that actually produce, if you're going to say Nirvana, I call it happiness, supreme happiness, how does the understanding produce that? Because my understanding of this moment could be, okay, this is a very nice afternoon, but it could also be a very sad time for some of us sitting here for some reason or other. So, how does the actual understanding of this precise moment...
Seeing that it's not permanent.
Does that bring happiness?
It's helpful because you are ready to face or to cope with any situation because you know that it's just very temporarily. It's just a moment.
You know that.
Yes, please.
You feel aversion or attachment, I think. Mm-hmm. Is that right? I think mm-hmm. There's two things, aversion and attachment. Past.
I think this is always one of our Western problems, or one of my Western problems, and I'm not particularly acquisition-minded and acquisitive. It is this notion of attachment. We can decathect, but we're still attached.
Right.
I mean, there is no question.
Attachment is attachment. Seeing is seeing. Can we say that seeing is Westerner? Or hearing is Chinese? Seeing is seeing. No,
but I mean our Western
yes,
sense.
Yes, I understand that.
Western sense of mm-hmm. We are attached to things.
Everyone, not just Western, yeah, yeah. Everyone, even animal kingdom, yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh.
But of course, animals, lower animals, do not have the sense of death. They are not haunted as people are. The moment that they're sentient, there is a sense of death, and animals are really, yes, they are aware that they kill. I mean, other animals eat, but the sense of their own death.
Robert Burns made a distinction between the mouse and he. The mouse was better off because he had no sense of his impending doom.
That's exactly right.
Whereas man does.
Exactly right.
Is that right? How do we know that?
Yes,
well,
I don't think
you're sure.
Well, yes, true. Yeah, but
animal sense is going to be killed.
It certainly can.
Fear,
yeah.
Certainly fear.
But not when I say impending death, I mean not the sense of we from quite. Yeah. I can speak for myself from quite young has been aware of death is there awaiting me. An animal, I don't think. I'm not sure. I don't think it's that sense. An animal being taken to the slaughterhouse can, I think, sense other animals panic. Probably, and they can then sense it. But I think Robert Burns is making that kind of comment about the animal.
As I said before, I think death is the one. I mean, it's hardly an original observation, but it's one
our
dreadful
own
universal
is the
thing.
One thing that
it's just dreadful. Wordsworth on imitation of mortality. Absolutely. I mean, it's just dreadful. I mean, this notion that there is an end of our days. It's not a pleasant thought. It's one that I go around with all
the time. But I am very happy around the thought. I'm very glad the world will spin round very nicely without me.
I guess I'm not. I guess that's part of my problem.
That's a tremendous relief, isn't it?
It is.
Can we say that as long as there is clinging, we don't feel that we would like to lose,
right.
No matter we call it death or not. So even the animal kingdom or cat and dogs doesn't want to lose life, no matter we call it life or not, or we call it death or not. But as long as one is born, one clings instantly to the beings.
Yes.
So as long as there is clinging, we don't have to use the conventional word like death, because one does not want to lose what one takes for life.
I guess that clinging, again, I'm sorry to dichotomize Western and Eastern, but clinging is very Western. I mean, it just is. I mean, the reality, and we study the philosophers like Bishop Berkeley, that this is not real. Of course it's real. And what I have and what I am is real. I mean, and it's this difficulty that we have. Maybe because of...
Can we say that both are real?
I mean, I think it's true for many.
Can we say that both are real?
What is real, sir?
Table.
Yes, this is real.
And it's not real in another sense.
Well, I guess I have a problem. To me, it's very real. I can measure it.
Yes.
I can count it.
All right. Table is real, right?
Yes.
Conventionally. And... table is not real in the absolute sense. Hardness is real when there is touching. Visible object is real when there is seeing.
Well, I mean, it's like that Zen puzzle. I mean, is there a sound if a tree falls in the forest and there's no one around to hear it? Does it make a sound? You know, there are these extremely philosophical...
I think that when there are conditions for sound to arise, it has to arise, no matter who hear it or not. So when there are conditions for hearing to arise, it experiences sound just at that very moment. No thought about tree falling in the forest or anything at all, because it's just sound. So we... can understand the difference between the conventional truth and the absolute truth. What we take for table and chair and people and thing are real in conventional term, conventional truth. But in absolute truth, seeing is real for a moment, hearing is real, thinking is real, but there is no permanent being. No name for all of us, but we have to use name to understand. the succession of these realities and the other realities. So when you think that you dislike someone, actually, what do you really dislike? The name or the reality of that person? Personality, deeds, action?
Everything.
Even name. Oh, you have
especially
the same
name.
You have the same name.
That conjures up.
Many Catherine, many Jonathan, not only one Jonathan. So what Jonathan that you dislike or you like? Because Jonathan is not just one Jonathan. See?
But there may be only one Jonathan Abbott.
Yes, or two.
There could be.
Yeah.
One Jonathan Abbott
you know. And love.
But that's meaning you're giving to a personal object. Doesn't actually change the nature of the object. Mm. Just because you've been given a name.
No. So one can see how much unwholesome one has accumulated, even name.
Even
it can condition
name.
Aversion. Yeah.
You rose by any other name and so forth.
So earlier, Victor, you mentioned about understanding. Sometimes when we think about understanding in conventional terms, we might say, oh, understanding, we're interested in understanding people or understanding nature or understanding being with one. But these are what Kunzichun would call conventional truths. Conventionally, that's right, and we all know what we mean. But absolutely, in absolute terms, these are not realities because they are only stories or ideas we have. So it's not the same as what she is talking about when she talks about understanding, seeing or hearing sound.
I think it's very important to distinguish. I mean, there's two sets here, what we talk about, the conventional and the unconventional, or the absolute truth or not the absolute truth. And talk about Zen and other things. Well, I mean, the understanding side of things and the absolute truth, I for one, always constantly trying to search for that, whatever we call the truth and the enlightenment or whatever it may be. And one thing is we can't get away from reality is that we are all influenced by our surroundings. You know, for example, if I'm working, so I've got a set of what I call reality, because I've got a set of colleagues around me, we've got a set of circumstances, or we in front of us we're discussing a certain topic. Now, whether or not that's reality or not, but the fact is that we're here in an afternoon talking about an understanding of certain truth. To me, I think the understanding is in an English sense, when compared to the Chinese sense, is quite different.
But if we forget about what is English sense and Chinese sense or Western sense or Thai sense, when we talk about being at work and being surrounded by problems and colleagues and having discussions and all of us here, these are concepts, ideas we have. They're not absolute realities that can be experienced at this moment. So what can be directly experienced at this moment? Hardness, visible object, sound, thinking. Now, because of different circumstances, you could say, after the sound or a visible object, there will be conditions for us all to think about different stories. That's okay. But the reality, the seeing, the thinking, the hearing, the sound at this moment is universal, common to all of us. It's not Chinese, it's not Thai, it's not English. Sound is sound. Visible object is visible object. Thinking about it is thinking. My thinking is no more special, it's nothing special. Thinking can think about anything, can think about Hong Kong Harbour, can think about annoying colleagues at work. They're just different stories, but the reality of thinking for an instant and now gone, now another moment, is common, is universal. So this is the difference between absolute realities and conventional realities. And as Kunsa Chin was saying, each of those realities is not someone, not something. And why do we cling so much to life or are so afraid of death? Because we cling so much to someone, this being, this Sarah, this permanent thing that sees and hears. But seeing sees for a moment, there's no being or person in it, and then it's gone, and then a moment of thinking, gone, no thing or being in it. It's just the story that puts a being or someone in it, or says this is a Chinese experience. So that's how the conventional and absolute realities are different. It doesn't mean we stop thinking about Jonathan and Kunsa Chin and sitting and having a discussion. Of course, this is our daily life. But while thinking and using these terms, we begin to understand that they're only stories, only concepts, not
moment
absolute
time.
Realities that can be experienced.
But then again, it's very difficult to for you not to think about it.
So it's not, the aim is not to stop thinking. The aim is to develop understanding.
Well,
it's not to change our life. It's not to go slower or get a new job or stop our job or sit in silence or be one with the universe. This is not our aim. Our aim is to just carry on as usual, but develop understanding of what the reality is at that moment.
It builds on the issue and concept of detachment from the problems.
For myself, I'm not very interested in whether it's this culture or that culture or whether it's called Buddhism or what it's called. I'm really only interested in understanding the truth of life and what can be proved at this moment. So, like Chin was saying, it doesn't really matter what words you use, but one can prove that clinging to seeing, clinging to sound, brings sorrow. So it doesn't matter whose answer you call it. I think it can be tested and proved, like if we talk about reality of seeing or sound. Well, this is something that we can test out. When you open your eyes, there is seeing. It's real. So I don't think it's a matter of one religion's answer or one culture's. I think it's a matter of what we can prove to be true.
Isn't there also a real dichotomy, perhaps, again between, if I use the words, East and West, that the Western religions, three great monotheistic Western faiths, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, as opposed to, let us say, Buddhism, Hinduism, Taoism, on the other side, a feeling among Westerners that the individual, perhaps, quote, matters, that we can, particularly in America, one of our basic credos is we can do something, we can do it. While in the East, it's changing, of course, but historically beset with poverty, cruel totalitarian governments, certainly nothing like democracy or individuality, there would have arisen, totally independently of a Western culture, a culture of acceptance. Now, admittedly, Islam is a bridge. The word Islam literally meaning submission. But I, for one, am not at all sure that in the Western faiths, Christianity, Judaism, or Islam, there really is this feeling of submission. There's this feeling of activism. In fact, jihad, holy war, exactly counteracts the notion of submission. We don't have to submit to indignity, we do something, war or whatever. While I get the feeling, maybe wrong, that a lot of notions about health in, let's say Hinduism or Buddhism, when we speak about reincarnation, I'm sick or something's wrong, well, this is something, a punishment for what happened in some other life, while and as opposed to this again clinging, if you will, to the notion of individuality and individualism and activism that we have in the West. Maybe it's not healthy. I'm not saying it's healthy or useful, but I've always seen it, and this great divide between, quote, East and West. Is this something that has any merit, or is it something that I sort of created out of whole cloth?
I thought Catholicism always teaches acceptance of misfortune as a way.
Complete misacceptance.
But also salvation, Catholicism teaches salvation actually through work.
And like the Greeks,
Protestantism teaches salvation through faith.
And the Greeks said, you know, he whom the gods love the most, he tries the hardest. And they had that concept of somebody who had suffering a lot, that he was chosen of the gods. Didn't they suffer to some extent?
Well, I think what the Greeks said is he who the gods love most, the gods punish, or the gods test.
Test the gods.
Certainly we all know
Catholic
about Job. Speech. We all know about Job, who was not, incidentally, Jewish. He was not Hebrew. He was a non-Hebrew. But I still have this feeling that Western rationalism, Cartesian rationalism, I mean, going back before, just this notion of the individual as more than just one of a grain of sand leads to this clinging, this battling, this you fighting, and that you have Abraham arguing with God. I mean, you know, will you save Sodom if there are 20 just men? And finally makes the bargain of 10. I've never really understood how they got to that number, but there is this feeling of arguing, you know, of fighting back again, of, if you will, then I like your word, clinging, that no, I will not give up. No, I do not accept temporality, I do not accept the fact that this is temporary by God, if you will. It's permanent and it's real, and, you know, and I'm not giving up. I'm sort of like the dog, you know, who grabs the, you know, sweater and just hangs on to it no matter what happens. Because certainly normatively in the East, with its huge population, even today in India, I mean, things still, I wouldn't say hopeless, that's not the word, it's great spirituality, but also great hopelessness through much of the East. And when you have this sort of actual physical, quote, hopelessness in a way, isn't it easier? Somebody said, if I'm going to be a king, I'd rather be a king of a Hindu or else Buddhist country than an actual Western country, where people have been conditioned through the millennia to accept, you know, and not necessarily to question.
I think until very recently in Western society, and I think what you're talking about really is a sort of education, social situation. I think until maybe just before the last war, for instance, I think there was a lot of poverty in Europe. I think in England, particularly, one can speak of, where people again accepted. They accepted their position in life.
Class system. You're talking about the class system.
In medieval times, when the king was of God, and everybody was in their place for a purpose, it was a godly purpose. I think until very recently, even perhaps to some extent in the States, people accepted their role in life as a poor, hard-working farmer in the Midwestern states, and accepted that.
One thing you could say, though, Neil, is, okay, if we forget about different nations for the moment and just think about people in this room, well, we know everyone has different characters. Some people are more aggressive, some are quieter, some more polite, everyone is different because of the way they've been brought up, and they have different nature, and however much or little understanding they have, back to your point, everyone's still going to be quite different. If someone develops a lot of understanding, it doesn't mean they're suddenly going to be a quiet, submissive personality, whereas before they've been allowed. We're not talking about that. But you could say, even though there are such different characters and personalities for different reasons, still what we have in common is everyone clings to life, everyone clings to having pleasant visible objects, to hearing pleasant sounds. One person may cling so much that they'll arrange a certain itinerary to try and have nothing but that pleasant sound or that nothing but that pleasant visible object. It doesn't matter, but the clinging is common, the seeing is common, the sound is common. Everyone will think about it in different ways. So yes, you can say, oh, some cultures are more independent or more aggressive, or some cultures seem to be more accepting of their lot or whatever, but the absolute realities are exactly the same.
Edwin was talking about last night, is this idea of I. Mm-hmm. We were talking about last night, but it's to get away from the I or the... Mm.
You mean the I yourself?
I myself. Can we say that what we are talking about are only concepts?
Concepts?
Yes.
No.
What concept? I'm sorry. Are you referring to? Yeah. I am not a concept. I am real. I mean, I'm just being quite. I mean, I exist. I am me, and that's it.
First start with the different concept of Taoism and Jewish and things. Can we say that these are concepts?
Well, these are all different faiths. These are ways of dealing.
I mean that what one is thinking about in terms of Taoism or Buddhism or Hinduism, is it concept?
Well, each of each of these faiths is a body of doctrine.
I don't think in terms of laboring or faith. I think in terms of thought or thinking. Is that right? There is thinking about such thoughts.
Oh, yeah, sure. There are each mm-hmm. systems of faith, right. And I'm thinking about
so
these.
So actually, it's only a moment of thinking.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. I may think about it differently tomorrow.
Yes.
I think about Taoism
yes.
slightly differently
and there
today
must be,
than I did before I came.
And there must be clinging to such thinking, such thought too, to believe in it.
That
there must be clinging.
I don't cling to. I cling to me. I don't cling
and
to
cling
ideas.
And cling to idea and concept.
Sorry?
And also cling to idea
no,
and concept.
This is where I may cling to me.
Yes.
But I don't cling to ideas.
So
I'm willing to change ideas, and I understand the impermanence of my thinking.
Yes.
I am quite willing, and have, of course, over the decades, changed my thoughts.
Religions, which not all religions would agree with you on that.
Mm. Because
if you take Judaism, in fact, you say that religious thoughts and the concept of religion. Well, religion is a concept of man, but in fact, God's generosity and his sincere wish to see a certain group of people succeed has been proven by history in their dealing with their own sufferings, for instance.
If we talk about generosity, it's real.
And that's proven.
It's real, isn't it? Generosity is real, right? Generosity is real.
Right.
No matter we talk about God's generosity or Queen Jonathan's generosity,
it's an act. I mean, it's an
generosity
act.
Itself is a reality.
It's an act,
It's an act.
But if we even don't talk about it as an act, if at the moment, for example, the moment of giving something, we forget about the action, but just at the moment, there is the mental state is real for that moment.
Yes, absolutely.
How did we all come to an existence? That's what I would like to know. If the Buddha had developed this fantastic, it has developed, which he has, don't doubt that, this insight of everything that there is to know and the interrelationship of all things and the knowledge of the universe, what is his idea of the creation story? How did we all come to be here and sit here now?
Yes.
And how is it all going to end?
Mm-hmm.
Will it ever end?
He taught us to understand this moment. Mm-hmm. When there is understanding of this moment, there is the understanding of the previous moment and the future moment as well. Because when we talk about realities, absolute truth, we don't have to call it or name it, who was born, how long ago. But the reality of this moment is conditioned to arise, and the next one, and the next one. So by understanding this, one can understand moments in the past that has to be exactly the same as present and future moments.
But that doesn't explain how we all here.
That is thinking about concept, idea again, thinking about the story of reality.
So we shouldn't question why we're here. We should detach ourselves.
It's not trying to understand concept, because concept is only thing or thought. But when there is understanding of reality, one knows that it's the absolute reality. So one understands the difference in one's life, that one used to live in the world of concept or conventional world, so many, many years ago, until one begins to understand what reality is. So one can see the difference between the world of concept and the world of absolute reality. Without absolute reality, there cannot be concept at all, no idea of anything, if there is no absolute reality.
Absolute reality is in fact not a natural state of existence, is it, or not a natural state?
It is this moment of the experiencing and the object which is experienced. Because when there is a reality which has to experience something, there must be the object which is experienced by that experiencing, just in a moment.
Because each one of us is in fact a result of, each one of us here defies the normal laws of nature, don't we, or physics, insofar as we are not in a steady state, are we, any of us? I mean, we're all full of turmoil. Our whole life is one of turmoil. And that turmoil is only brought to an end at the point of death, when we disintegrate totally and our whole physical body disappears and it goes back into the earth where it came from, and the steady state yet once more.
May I ask, what dies?
What dies?
The body.
When you talk about death, we have to die. What dies?
My body will die.
The physical part of us dies.
Flesh. There's no question. The body itself dies. It disintegrates. I mean, unless it's mummified. It dies.
It does.
It just does. I mean, that's just a fact.
Does it die now?
At the point of... Well,
it's dying.
The body starts to... We start to die at the moment of, obviously, birth.
Yes.
We start to die. And birth is... Birth is a truly fatal condition.
Yes.
Because it leads to death. I mean, that's a fact of life. Yes, the body dies. Then the question is there an essence? Is there a soul? Whether it's an Atman or we call it a soul.
Sorry, when you say we... Just to pick up. When you say we start to die at birth...
At birth.
You mean
cells are formed and die. I mean, you know...
We are dying all the time.
We are dying all the time. Sure, physically, sure. Absolutely. We die and we
So grow. What's different about... Death, that's conventional that. Death too.
Because all of it stops, that's all I know.
Yes,
and my consciousness ends, and that for me is death. I mean, you know, when I am no longer in it, when I no longer can come here to be 1942 and have these discussions and think and work and live, you know, it's that's death. I mean, it really is.
In well, maybe
way,
we can introduce euthanasia at that point.
Well...
But all in the same way that the essence of what is Jonathan is permanent, it always will be.
If someone knows Jonathan,
there will there never was a Jonathan before Jonathan came into this world. There will never ever be another Jonathan as long as the world exists. And what is the essence of Jonathan is permanent.
Only if someone
always,
recalls
there
it.
Will be no other Jonathan. There will be no other essence of Jonathan. There may be in a parallel universe somewhere
else. Does it? The fact that we're each is distinct and individual doesn't mean permanence.
But what I'm talking about is the essence, is the things that you have held dear whilst you lived, the people that you loved whilst you lived, the good deeds that you did whilst you lived, the bad deeds as well, they're permanent. They will always, that will always exist. And that will happen for every single one of us. Well, of course they are. I mean, that you can't measure it in the realities that we understand. You can't weigh it. But the actions, the spiritual essence of what Jonathan is, what he did, what he was for his friends, he was for his parents and what he was in anything in his for his colleagues, that's always, that will always be there long after.
What I am to other people is simply
isn't
a creation of their
isn't
a creation of their
experience of thinking.
But the memory that you create, that you create in people who have had contact with you, which they will pass that on. Perhaps I met this strange guy on the NTR. <You know? laughs> You'll tell that to your children, or you know, there's this guy working in Hong Kong, and that encounter with you perhaps might strike somebody, you know, as being a worthwhile lifelong memory, which will be passed on to a child, and who will remember that, and that's passed on again. That may even go down in a book for other people to read.
But that's
permanent.
But I'm thinking though, considering that's not an absolute reality.
I'm not sure if I understand. I the more I listen to what we're saying here, the more careful I become in my choice of words, because I'm not sure I understand by what you actually mean when you talk about an absolute reality. I could be totally misunderstanding the issue you're trying to put across. And what is real,
well,
and what is real, and what is, I mean, if you take, of course, you can't argue, you can't disagree with the concept that at any split moment in time, a certain set of conditions exist, which we all experience, and then in the next split moment of time, they've all changed. Of course, they have. You can't argue with that. And if at that split moment in time, that's reality, absolute reality, then I'll accept that for what it is, if that's the description of it.
But you're saying,
and of course, your brain can't memorize that, because things happen so fast, and everything is impermanent, because all conditions change instantly, and they do that.
I think it's much simpler than that. All we're saying is, at any moment, at any present moment, there are things that are real, and things that are conceptual.
But the love that you have for certain people is as real as the show.
At this moment, if I have a certain feeling at this moment, that's real. But if I have another feeling, or if I'm experiencing different feelings or sense experiences, they are real at that moment, whatever. But the thoughts I have, the concepts I think about at this moment, are different. They are not real. So the name that I give to you isn't real. But the seeing, the visible object, the hearing, and the like, if I taste some food, I like it, or whatever, that's real at that moment. That's a common experience that everyone has. These are universal experiences, and we can call them realities. To distinguish them from the word peanut, for example, which is a concept. And when I think that's a peanut, that's a concept. But the experiencing of the taste of the peanut at that moment is something that is directly experienced, that anyone who has taste sense and who eats that will experience.
Would you call that as reality, Jonathan?
I'm sorry? Would I call it a reality?
Yeah, I mean, that moment that you taste that peanut, for example, using an analogy.
Well, I think the moment comprises realities, yes, like the tasting of the taste of the peanut at that moment is a reality.
Would you call that as absolute reality?
You could call it absolute reality.
I'm trying to get my definition
well,
clear.
Yes, that's what we are. Okay, yes, I'd call it an absolute reality in the same way as I would call the sound that I hear at the moment absolute reality.
Okay. Yes.
But the reason when Neil, for example, was discussing different religions or philosophies, and she said, well, are these concepts? Because most of the time we live in a world of concepts. We think that we're eating a peanut cookie now, or we think that our story about Hong Kong and people at work is real. Most of the time we live under the illusion that this is reality. So it doesn't mean that we stop thinking about different religions or about peanut cookies or Hong Kong side, but we should begin to realize that these are only stories. You can't say that one is inherently better or worse in terms of reality, because they're all stories. So what is important is to understand that the thinking is real, but the story is only a story. It's just a dream, different from the reality of taste or visible object or sound. Experienced at this moment.
Another example, when someone says something, I react, and that reaction might be with irritation or it might be with amusement. That is real. That's something that's experienced at that moment. what I think about what the person said or what I think I'm going to say is not in the same sense real. Thinking, yes, is real, but the thoughts...
You mean it's not instantaneous?
Perhaps that wasn't a very good example, but I'll go back to what I said before, that if someone says something and I react in a certain way, whether it's instantaneous or not, but the irritation will say that I feel if someone ticks me off is real.
It could be a concept too.
If I think about it, it's a concept.
Can we say that concept follow the experience of reality?
Mm-hmm.
So the experience of reality and concept arise alternately.
Do they have any sequence? Like, you know, what Jonathan's saying, if I say something to you, you respond right away, then that is reality in the definition. And if you have to think about it and to respond, then it's a concept.
I think it's better don't think about order, but at the moment of thinking now, thinking is real, it's directly experienced. But oh, I have such an annoying colleague at work who always does this and that to me. This is just a story.
It's a moment in time.
I don't think it matters whether you call it a moment in time or not, but what we can say is, oh, I have such an annoying colleague and he always does things to annoy me. It's just a story. It's not a reality. There is no annoying colleague in reality. In reality, there's just a moment of thinking and then gone.
But it does annoy you, though.
So what is one thinking for a moment?
I know.
There's a sound. There's a sound and there's thinking. These are the only realities. In reality, there's no annoying colleague. It's just thinking and sound if we really want to get back to present moment and what is actually real now. Just like you think we see Hong Kong Harbour and all the beautiful sight and the buildings and the sunshine on the water. But in reality, it's a moment of seeing and thinking. But Hong Kong Island and the buildings and the water, it's just a story, just a dream.
I don't quite follow your stories. And I must admit that I am more a concrete thinker and driven by facts. But the reality that I visualize, take an average person in Hong Kong, it seems an average working person, it seems to me that their whole life generally is based on reality. They get out of a real bed and they dress in clothes appropriate to the weather today, and they eat and they go on a real MTR to a real building, you know, etc. It seems to me that every moment of their lives, except the task or some thoughts about family or something, and generally those are reality-based also, money or education, whatever, that their whole life is really based on reality, and that thinking of concepts in general is something that we do after we have tended to the realities of our life. When we've safely got a seat on this real subway. That's just, you know, my reaction. So I'm a bit confused about all else. When we look at the harbor, it's really stories. You know, I don't understand your application of the term story. To me, the harbor is real, and that boat I'm on better be really safe.
Better be real, you would be a good friend. But if you say most people get on a real MTR, how is the real MTR experienced? What is seen? Because what is seen, we've said, is only visible object. What is experienced through the body sense is hardness and coldness. So how is the real MTR experienced? If it isn't just a story.
Well, no, the real MTR has a function. It gets me to point B, and I wouldn't be at point B because it's too far and too hot to walk. And I can't afford a cab. So this is more than a story. It is an actual material object with a function, this subway. It's more than a story. You know, it's great reality, as is most of the other objects in my life.
So this is what Konsichin was earlier talking about when we were talking about the difference between conventional and absolute realities. I mean, conventionally, yes, this is a table and this is a chair and this is the floor that is experienced, and without these things, all the food would get spilled on the floor and people would feel uncomfortable. So conventionally, this is perfectly correct, and I completely agree with you. So it doesn't mean we stop talking about chairs and tables, and it certainly doesn't mean we stop using them. But if we are interested to know absolutely what is experienced at this moment in order to get rid of the illusion of someone or self in absolute terms, we can prove that what is seen is only visible object, and it's the thinking, it's the story of table and people and chairs. So there's a difference between what is the absolute reality and the conventional reality at that moment. So it doesn't mean that the conventional reality is useless or worthless or that we shouldn't use it, but we begin to understand that it is only a conventional reality.
Are you saying that, for example, just getting back to your analogy about the colleague at work or the child or the parent whom we don't like and who is a vulgar, pain in the ass, that yes, that exists, but you're saying the higher reality is our feeling, and that feeling can be adjusted, that this person can be tuned in, tuned out, and so forth, if we go back to essences rather than this is the way he or she is at this moment. And the way that is based on my reaction to it rather than what this person is. And are you saying that the important thing about an MTR or a ferry or something is not its physical form, but its ability, our reaction to it? It is a comforting way of getting from here to there, but that the reality as such, while it's there, there's no question in my mind it's there, this is not the important thing to focus on. Is this what you're saying?
Well, what I'm saying is if we really understand our lives, precisely understand the realities, we will see things clearer. So back to the colleague at work, we think that the problem in our life is the fact that we've got a difficult, demanding boss or a colleague who always comes in and annoys us. But the reality is seeing and sound and clinging to certain sights and sounds and aversion to others. So if someone speaks too loudly or something is heard, immediately there's a long story about, oh, how dare he come in and do that, and I'm busy. What is actually causing the problem is not the colleague, but the
our reaction,
the thinking and the aversion and the... So, I mean, this is just one example of the value of understanding realities, because otherwise we live in the world of the concepts and we think the real problem in our life is the colleague and the...
But don't we then have to, if we carry this search for whatever we call usefulness far enough, is there not then choices we have to make? Either we must change our reactions to this person, or choose not to react all one way or another, just go on with our own work, or leave that situation, or else murder the colleague. I mean, in other words, do something. Because you can't re-educate people. I mean, I'm convinced of that. You can't make a real human being out of a rat bag. I mean, I'm convinced of that. So I've tried on at least one or two. Anyway. So then are you saying ultimately that what we need to do is to adjust our thinking, to deflect it, or else it is going to so gnaw us that it will just destroy us? Is that what you're suggesting?
Well, we could say that conventionally we can turn left or right or do this or that, and there are various courses and methods that we can follow to decide which one to do, and it will depend on, we may decide to turn left, but in fact when we come to the junction, turn right. We may decide not to say anything, but when he comes into our room, come out with a torrent of abuse. So this is fine conventionally, and it doesn't mean we don't follow or do this, but in reality we could say that there is no one, and the realities in life are actually conditioned. So
what happens happens as a result of conditions anyway, so what is more important is to develop understanding, because in fact there is no choice or no one who can turn left or right. So again, we have these two layers, if you like. So conventionally we can say, oh, when he comes into my room I'm going to do this, okay, but in reality, who can stop the seeing at the moment? Who can control what thought we will have at this next moment?
We can change ourselves if we want to. We have the ability to change ourselves if we should wish to do so. And what we're talking about, in fact, is how to deal with the suffering of one kind or another. Mm. It's an irritating colleague. And one could deal with this subject by saying, I accept that irritating colleague completely for what he appears to be to me here. After all, I only see a fraction of that person's personality during the working day. I know absolutely nothing about him. He could be a much, much, or she could be a much, much better person than I. And thereby, perhaps coming to terms with the fact that that person, if you can accept the person for the way he is in your conventional, then. And perhaps inject into that the person, in fact, that is irritating towards you may, in fact, have much, much more positive qualities than you do, but you're not aware of them, then that's one way of dealing with that suffering. That puts your own mind to rest, doesn't it? It's just something you have to accept, and accept it without questioning.
And again, I think this is this notion of acceptance, some of us are better at than others.
Or, yes, it's very difficult, isn't it? Or you can deal with it perhaps as you're always also explaining, that you can say, conventional wisdom tells me that this person is an absolute, but the reality of the situation is that it's just a fleeting moment, and the absolute reality is completely different.
Do you mean that
it's just two
you
different
understand
ways
the conditions
dealing?
For changing? It depends on conditions, right? Any kind of changing depends on conditions.
Any kind of change.
For example, do you think that you can extinguish fire?
Yes. Extinguish fire. Use a fire extinguisher.
Because you understand the conditions.
Yeah, that's the condition.
But the self cannot do anything to extinguish fire.
Not unless I have
it
fire.
It depends on conditions,
yeah, sure.
Right?
Of course.
So what one thinks depends on conditions, even such thinking. Why the other people do not think like you, see? Depending on conditions.
But I have to live through this. I mean, the condition is that I have to live through this, let's use an unkind word, bastard. And it is a fact. I mean, it is not an imaginary thing. And he or she has control of my life at business. Whether or not you may deny it, it's a fact of life. He has power of firing or hiring, and in some cases, life and death. And this is a fact. I mean, this is not an actual musing. I mean, this is a fact. And I guess the question is, the Buddha's whole purpose was to teach man how to understand the illusion, pain, and so forth, and to try to mitigate suffering by the Eightfold Path and so forth. And we can come to terms with that, or any of the other organized religions, or indeed secular humanism. But the reality is that we do have to do something. We either have to change the other person, which is usually hopeless, or change ourselves.
Sorry.
Yes, but
or change ourselves.
But is this possible to do? Is this possible?
I think that we are talking about six things, right? Six, only six. Seeing is one thing, hearing is another thing, smelling, tasting, touching, and then thinking. So there are in the world only six doorways to experience. Like, if there is no thinking, there is no idea, no thought at all, right? There can be just seeing, no idea, no thinking about the object which is seen. So we have to come to understand thinking, no matter it's thinking about relation or thinking about colleagues or thinking about concrete or anything, it's only thinking, which is different from seeing. Because seeing sees, it cannot think, it cannot do anything. And thinking cannot see, it cannot hear, it just think after seeing and hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. And what one is thinking about is only thinking in words, right? Thinking in words about bananas.
Also pictures.
Oh, pictures, yes.
Pictures, yeah. Words, mm-hmm, pictures, right. Potential actions.
Right.
Absolutely.
But sometimes one thinks in words.
You can.
Like we are talking about now, there must be thinking of words. So it's only the memory of sound, right? If there's no memory of sound, no word. So it depends on memory of what is seen, what is heard, what is taught to condition such different thinking. So there are many ideas and concepts, but concept and idea is only thought, the object of thinking only. Which arises and falls away, it cannot stay. Nothing can stay. Thinking cannot stay. Hearing cannot stay.
But the pain can stay.
Pain?
The pain of that colleague that he or she causes can stay. It's an eternal thing. That does not go away. That's permanent. Well,
please tell me where it is now.
What? Where?
Pain.
He's lost it for the moment.
Pain can be anywhere. It can be made mental. It can be made psychosomatic.
Not at
it
moment of seeing. Not at moment of hearing.
It can cause me to lose my job, which is painful.
But at moment of thinking, okay.
Painful. No, that's an action. It's not thinking. It's an action. No, this is translated into action. And that is a very painful thing. This is not a concept now.
I don't understand what...
Well, he's saying that if as a result of the argument with the colleague who is your boss, you lose your job,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
Therefore, the pain has become permanent. Because, but in what sense is that pain?
Well, what if you lose your home and your family, you know, your wife abandoned you? I mean, financially, you're bankrupt.
But
then we're back to the things we cling to.
I would say that
they're all different.
Mm-hmm. All different, though, aren't they? And if while after you've lost your job, you have a nice dinner and a pleasant time, at moments there's no pain.
I don't. But I have no money to. No, I'm serious now. I have no money to pay for this dinner. No, really, I'm quite serious. I've lost my job, and eventually I've lost everything, just falling a little short of even losing my mind. But I have really lost. Now, if you say, and I'm not saying that one should cling, unfortunately, in my normative way as an American, let's say, as a Western American, I do cling. I cling to the memories of that job, and I cling to memories of unfairness and revenge and all these sort of things, and what I had. The greatest pain for man, and I think it was Dante who said it somebody, is remembering good things in times of in bad times. That is probably the greatest pain in many ways that man can observe. And that pain that he has caused me is very real. And this is not something that I'm imagining now, because my bills come and I can't pay them. Now you can say that the notion of having to pay the bills is clinging, because I want to cling to my apartment or my family or my possessions. Now, perhaps the answer is to not want to cling, to be able to, as Jesus said, sell your possessions, abandon your father and mother, and then follow me. That is another way of dealing with reality. It is not one that is immediately appealing to most.
This is why it's so important to define the terms, if you like, because because you talk about pain being, I can't write a check to pay the rent. That's not pain in the sense, for example, that if someone whacks you on the head and you experience pain. Now, at that moment, there is pain that you're directly experiencing, kind of pain. Now, at other moments, there is thinking, for example, remembering what I've lost. I lost so much on the stock market.
Yes.
Oh, what an idiot. There's unpleasant feeling. But the unpleasant feeling is unpleasant. But you can't say at that moment, or if you do say at that moment that the pain is the loss on the stock market, then again you're talking in concepts, because what is the reality of that moment is the unpleasant feeling, or if you've been struck on the side of the head is the painful feeling. We try to be more precise.
Well, I mean, both.
We're talking about, for example, we're talking about pain. We want to be precise.
But well, in all cases, I actually can be precise. The pain is the loss of less money. The pain is the physical damage to the head. All of these, again, if you want to be quantitative about it, these can be measured. I mean, these are measurable. There's also the concept of pain and of hurt. But there's also the physical and the tangible manifestations of it. Now, the loss itself, to some people, there comes a point where the loss of this, you know, money, I'm glad I don't have to worry about it anymore. That can be not only not pain, but non-pain can be, theoretically. But for many people, particularly family to support, I think that would be a cruel rationalization and almost a source of you, as usually conceived.
So what about the person who has lost money but has confidence that he will be able to get another job and somehow things will be provided for?
That's fine. I think that's wonderful. So, that's enviable.
So what's the difference between that person and the person who thinks the other way, that doom and disaster, everything lost, and because both have suffered the same loss.
Exactly. You say the loss, their reactions to it that may be different. Exactly.
That is right.
And so, many people can react.
So what is painful in the case of the person who is reacting adversely to it?
I think in both cases, the pain, the hurt, mentally, emotionally, physically. Now, our reactions to pain and to hurt was wildly different. Some people can bounce back. And be almost inured from feeling, while others are deeply hurt. And again, I hate to bring up the East-West divide, but I've noted quite clearly that my students at the university tend to have extremely high-quality, fragile egos. Again, it's a cultural thing. They don't get a job, and they say, I didn't get this job. What should I do? I say, what do you think you should do? Go try again. While I think an American is so accustomed to being battered from pillar to post that we do suffer and we are hurt, but by God, you know, we're going to go on anyway. Rather than, it's a notion of acceptance, I think. And again, I guess I'm just not terribly good at acceptance. I guess others perhaps are. I'm just not terribly good at it. Maybe I'd be better if I were.
And also go to the example. Say if I got bankrupt, I lost money, big money in a stock transaction. Well, at the beginning, I think I might be feeling that it has caused some pain. But in the long term, maybe, have you been earning a lot of money, you became a millionaire, maybe you got some of other attractions, and you got divorced with your wife, things like this. Whereas if you're not becoming millionaires, your wife will be beside you, encouraging you to start over again, and then you get a more peaceful life.
It may be.
So what you felt in the beginning is, hey, it may turn out to be goodwill.
Absolutely. That's irony. And I find irony is something that my students also have a very poor sense of. Things turning out totally different from what they should.
Irony aside, Tony's point is that if you call the conventional loss pain, we don't actually know, because what we take for being a misfortune often turns out to be good fortune. So it's how we react to it at the moment.
I agree.
If there is an adverse reaction, there'll be unpleasant feeling.
Yes, absolutely.
If there is a positive reaction or an equanimous reaction, there won't be unpleasant feeling. So that is just one aspect of the reality of that present moment. We are suggesting it's useful.
Sorry to interrupt. I mean, that's probably also an aspect of clinging as well. Because, you know, you cling to so much pain, you've lost a job.
I'm not letting it go.
Exactly.
That's right.
Right.
I mean, this pain, by God, I don't care what happens, but this pain is mine, and nobody is going to make me give it up. It's true. It's a very common thing, you know. I love it. I mean, you know.
Yeah, it's pulsating to your heart.
It's the martyr complex.
The martyr complex, right.
sets the adrenaline going and drives me to ever higher feelings of work and frustration and more pain.
I mean, you know,
yes.
Often you consider in the conventional sense is, oh, okay, this guy doesn't want me, doesn't value me. Then you say, you know, it's their loss.
You have other more colorful phrases in English, which we won't use in this company.
In
yes, that is loss.
Mr. Chen's going to say something. You're going to say something about the pain.
Yes, as you're saying, the pain is permanent.
It can be.
It can be, or is
if,
it?
If we let it be.
Yeah.
Do you mean that it arises again?
It never leaves. I mean,
because it arises and arises and arises again and again.
Yes.
But it has to pass away and then arise again. Because at moment of seeing, there is no pain at all. At moment of hearing, there is no pain. But pain can arise later. And it can arise again and again and again. So it looks or it seems like it's permanent.
Well, I think it can arise, I don't mean to be argumentative, at that moment of seeing and hearing when we get terrible news about either our job or our family or our friends or ourselves.
Always.
It arises instantly. You know, you have cancer. In the odd medical world, you've tested positive. Everywhere else in the world, positive is good. In the medical world, it's bad. You've tested positive. That pain starts then, and it doesn't, you know, go away. It doesn't subside.
Can we say that when we lose something, no matter what one sees, after that there is unpleasant feeling, not enjoying even the object is so pleasant, and hearing something which is so pleasant, but when it's that time, you don't feel pleasant, you don't have pleasant feeling. So after seeing and hearing, unpleasant feeling arises, follows each doorway, so it seems permanent. But in its nature, nothing can be permanent, because at moment of seeing, there is no pain. But after that, unpleasant feeling can follow.
Again, I suppose with one who takes it literally, I mean, my experience is at the pleasant of seeing,
mm-hmm.
moment of seeing, the
certainly,
pain arises.
Certainly.
Instantaneously.
Yeah, yeah. Like now, it seems like seeing and hearing are simultaneously, right? But actually, they cannot be seeing and hearing together at the same moment.
Well, not physically, because sound takes time to travel, and theoretically, your words, I see your actual lips move, and there's a split nanosecond before I hear your words. Well, that's certainly true physically.
Mm-hmm.
No, I think the point is something different. Put it, let's suppose you're not looking at the person speaking, you're looking somewhere else, we'll say, okay.
Right.
I think what Christensen's saying is that that you're hearing the person speak, right?
Mm-hmm.
The hearing and the seeing that appear to be contemporaneous are not in actual fact happening at the same moment.
I suppose it might be true conceptually. I just have difficulty grasping it as a Cartesian rationalist, that's all.
But why is this important?
Yeah, yeah.
Why is it so important? That's what I don't understand.
To understand that nothing is permanent, even what you take is so very seriously unpleasant, like losing job or things like that, it's just in the moment.
But it goes on.
Yes, arising again, again and again. But the actual reality, which is conditioned to be unpleasant, cannot stay, but it can arise again.
I take it when you lose your job, it affects you personally.
Sure it does. You know? Absolutely.
Yeah,
in every way.
And then you just do all the things that you said, how would that affect me?
What is significant of the fact that it rises and falls, rises and falls, mm-hmm. rather than stays? What is the importance of the fact that there's this time,
mm-hmm.
space
mm-hmm.
we're talking about, this mm-hmm. moment in time? Why is that so important?
To understand realities as they are, as not self, as no body, no thing at all, only realities, absolute reality, that you cannot change any characteristic of each reality, like hardness is hardness, you cannot do anything or you cannot change.
Mm-hmm.
Pleasant feeling is pleasant feeling, it's not unpleasant feeling. Yeah. to understand realities as they are, as being conditioned for its arising, and it cannot stay.
I could give a slightly different answer since you addressed the question to me, because that's only thinking. But if I want to understand more about the present moment, whether it's someone talking or whatever's happening at the moment, then I want to understand the different realities that make up that moment.
Yes, I understand that's what you're trying to perceive.
Right.
And you are perhaps perceiving that?
Oh, probably not. No.
I'm just wondering what
difference it makes.
Yes, that's,
I think
that's
it's,
my question too.
Yeah. I think it's just a case of understanding what's going on.
But that's the reality of it, isn't it? I think there are three key words, to my understanding, in this particular session. We talk about understanding absolute reality and the concept. That's my way. That's my perception of it. And to me, my understanding of the understanding, so to speak, is somehow and somewhat translated to me as realization. To me, it's a realization of the probably the world around us, and to be part of this particular world, and to be part of in one with this particular moment in time. That's one thing. But I have a problem in a way of still trying to understand the absolute reality and the reality that I still not so sure what I'm trying to absorb from this particular moment in time. That's my feeling of it.
How can there be one reality? Let us assume a child born in Somalia today and one in Ethiopia and one in New York or whatever. I mean, there are so many different realities for individuals.
Or you could say life is the same for everyone.
But it isn't.
Well, in
you know,
in
if
what?
You're starving to death from the moment you're born to the other kind of life and all these strata in between.
But so still in the sense of everyone has the same faculties and experiences various inputs, if you like, through those faculties.
But I think their whole life is colored by a different kind of experience. I mean, a child that experiences physical hunger his whole life, I mean, he's even his faculties are not as keen at birth because he's been deprived of the nutrients and so forth. And his motivations, you know, he'll steal from another baby a piece of bread. His whole goals in life are so different. The way he views a mother, I mean, a non-responsive, starving mother herself.
One thing you could say is that for everyone, no matter rich or poor or here or there, you could say that the real problems in life or the real suffering in life ultimately is not whether you get this promotion or that this house to live in or an extra nice meal or not, but the real problems come down to being clinging or greed, our ignorance and our aversion, because in the end, you know, two people can be in an identical situation, and but as Neil said, react totally differently.
Yes,
so ultimately you could say the real problems in our life are the clinging, the ignorance and the aversion. Now you might say, well, why does it matter? But you could say, you know, a mother might try to teach her child, well, it's better to share your food with your friend, and the child say, why? Well, because at the moment of generosity, it's wholesome, it's a good thing to encourage. And in the same way, a moment of understanding, at that moment, there is no ignorance, there is no darkness, there is no blindness. So at that moment, it's clear or it's light, or just for an instant, we see realities as they are. So it just depends on what one's goals are in life, or how one sees the problems ultimately.
Well, one has, I mean, the realities of sense are there, aren't they? The senses of seeing and hearing and so on.
Exactly.
But the gift of generosity or charity or whatever else you'd like to call it, is not the same. I mean, that's the fact that you
not to the same degree.
No, the fact that you can see things and feel things and so on doesn't make you a better person. No. Your reality of that I can touch that and I say, my reality is that's hard. That's not a table, but it's hard. Yeah, okay, it's a table, but it's hard. That doesn't make me a more generous person. It doesn't make me a better person.
But more understanding.
Yes, I could agree. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So, if one wants to become a better person,
yes.
If one understands more clearly about oneself, one knows that, for example, generosity arises at certain times and not other times. One sees it as it is. One certainly understands other people better, because one sees that all these things are conditioned. We can't make ourselves more generous.
Maybe the understanding leads to a greater understanding of the aversion and clinging thing. And once you get to that understanding, then from that develops perhaps the idea of what I'd call detachment. Therefore, in that kind of situation, more generosity and more good feelings and more compassion, that has room to grow.
Earlier, that if you've been through a traumatic experience where you lose your job, you lose everything, and so on, it's a tremendous period of suffering. You may come out of that. I think you established yourself, there is inevitably something good will come. It may come out.
Not inevitably,
well,
possibly.
The moment that period of suffering is also beneficial, I suppose, insofar as it's character building. And to the extent that all of us have to build our own characters, and in order, because without building and improve and extending our character, we're not able to perhaps reach our trust. For instance, you would perhaps not be in a position to help others to say that you'd experienced a situation where you'd lost everything and you'd come through that. The positive aspects are that you'd perhaps be able to help somebody else who comes and says, I've just blown everything on the stock exchange. And what should I do? Now, if you've been through that situation, you would know, and you would be able to reach out and help that person. I don't know whether this has any significance at all.
I was thinking
in that sense that everything. So you need to. I think it's necessary for everybody to go through.
It might happen, but do you need to have had that bad experience to want to help another person? And are we talking about wanting to help or knowing the answers?
If you have been in a position where you yourself have suffered, where you've not had enough money, or been in a situation where you've not been able to purchase food, to provide nourishment for yourself or your loved one, and you come through I would like to think that experience itself, there's that feedback that perhaps makes you more generous towards others.
I hate to contradict you, but as a social worker, going through research...
I know what Bob is going to say.
The children who went through direct versus direct experience.
Children who have been abused turn out to be the most abusing parents. Instead of saying, oh dear, I was abused, I will be so sweet and kind because I know what it was to suffer.
I accept that.
Yeah,
but I think that it would mean, O'Neill, if you had this understanding, let me think this out for a minute, if you had the understanding of the realities and therefore the feeling of the not letting aversions and clinging affect you too much, if you find yourself in that condition, I think you might then be able to say to yourself, well, the reality of my situation is that is not the real thing in my life, all these tragedies, I mean, they're affecting me and I'm hurting because of it. But I must remember that it's not the true reality. It's this moment in time. If I try and live with this moment in time. And in that sense, I think it's a bit like the theory, perhaps, one lives a day at a time and you have problems that one can cope with it better. I think maybe is that what it's all about, is that you can, in understanding the aversions and the clinging, that when you find yourself in a difficult position, you can perhaps cope with it more because you realise it's not the reality.
Well, I think one of the things is that many of us would choose to choose our own character building experiences. We'd rather not have them be thrust upon us. That is not what I consider to be one of the better things in life. And I think we are, sometimes we are forced to turn to that sort of thinking, that, well, maybe it isn't the only thing that matters. I still have my family, as long as I have my family. Of course, if I don't get much money, I'm going to lose my family. Certainly reversals and adversities certainly can change us, usually for the worse, but possibly for good. And I think it depends how we react. And I always counsel, after these bad experiences, first thing is to have, and this is no secret, this is a death and dying thing, a period of extreme anger. I mean, you're angry, and then I usually counsel total disgust, that this is above these feelings that I have towards such and such, such and such, are above just infradig, below dignity, that these are not even worth my taking my time to think about. And then you proceed on. But you do need to, I think for most of us, go through this feeling of absolute anger and revenge, feelings of revenge, and then the fact that, well, this is not productive, and then we have to move. And that's the whole theory of productive anger versus is just unproductive anger. And I think this anger is part of clinging. I mean, the anger that what I had, I've lost. And if one could follow the Buddha's theories to the fullest, this notion of self, as I said before, in fact, Hinduism teaches the union of the Atman, the individual self, the actual Brahman, the great world soul. And of course, one of the things Buddhism did was to deny the reality of an individual soul. The whole point is that so much that we think it is reality is not reality. It is illusion. It is clinging. Unfortunately, this takes a long time.
Yes, because the attitude should be, who am I to think I can get through life unscathed?
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Sure.
Nobody put a tag on my arm when I was born saying this child will be fortunate, have everything go her way.
Exactly.
That's not life.
But all of us in the back of our minds still think this, regardless. And we all want to die at a very old age, in our beds, peacefully, surrounded by our children and grandchildren, great-grandchildren. This is a fact.
Pride,
of
we sometimes talk about pride.
Mm.
That is pride.
It's a great danger in living to a ripe old age.
Yes.
Better to go early.
I'll choose that.
Would you like to have less clinging?
Sorry?
Would you like to have less clinging?
I think so. Ideally, I would like to be, most of all, freed from the fear and horror of actually death. Other things I can accept. I can accept the illness. I can accept lost jobs. I mean, personal indignities. But the greatest indignity of all, death. No, that a negation of everything that I've ever worked for, I mean, building a life, that I certainly would be like to be freed from. And since I cannot accept the normative Judeo-Christian Islamic Western monotheistic ideas of a life after death and heaven and hell. I mean, I can't. It may be.
So what's your answer? Yes or no?
What?
Yes.
The answer is yes.
Yes. Yes.
Of course, yes.
I was just waiting.
But only on death.
Yes.
Only about death.
Okay.
Only about death.
Because we know that we cling a lot. We cling to everything which we see and hear and think about, right? Even thinking is conditioned by clinging. Tomorrow, what would happen? What will we have for dinner tonight? Even thinking is clinging.
Yes.
So what kind of clinging that you would like to have less, because we have to lessen the clinging stage by stage? We cannot give up all kinds of clinging yet. So what is the first clinging that you'd like to have
this
less?
This is the point. I'm sorry if it sounds so blunt, But those are not the sort of clingings I'm anxious to give up. I do think that as a human being, I have part of my being human is this notion of concern for tomorrow and my family and my next job next summer in Hawaii again. This sort of thing, this constant concern, some of it unproductive, but quite a lot of it productive. These sort of clingings and the wanting to have at least a minimum amount of physical comfort, these sort of clingings I don't want to give up. But the clinging that I do want to give up to is this clinging to the notion that I will be here forever when I know I'm not, and the thought that I'm not makes me so unhappy. Now, I know what you're going to say, that you can't get rid of that without unpeeling, without getting rid of each of the layers in between. And that, of course, is very, very difficult for a normative Westerner.
I would say that it's possible if we can eradicate the clinging to the self or to the idea of self first. Because we cannot give up the clinging to everything as long as there is the idea of clinging of self. So when we have understanding of what we cling as self, clearly we will have less clinging to what we used to take for self.
That's true.
Without understanding, it's impossible to try or to wish to have less. So to your question about what is the benefit of understanding realities, one knows that clinging arises from ignorance, not understanding reality as it is. So when there is more understanding, there will be less clinging to the self, and then later on, it will lead to less and less clinging to other things.
But I'm not sure that less clinging, for me at least, would be the ultimate goal. I admire, and I would like to be able to myself to even have more interests as time goes on. People are interested in the garden and flowers, and they want more hobbies, and they're interested in literature and causes, and they volunteer and they organize and they march on Washington. I mean, I think that's marvelous to be so involved in so many interests in life besides family and friends. I think that these people are very rich. And it's not a life of abstinence, but a life of fullness that I aspire to. Lots of that I would wish and I admire in other people.
When you have less clinging to the idea or to the notion of self, it doesn't mean that you have less interest.
Okay, then you've explained that.
Because of one's individual accumulation, you cannot stop having it. Yes.
I think the only thing is, I was just going to comment, is what one has to be careful of in being, as it were, a joiner, is that you're not using the joining as a form of clinging.
No, but I mean causes and friends and
so that,
whatever
you know,
interests
you. I think it could be true to say some people, my theory is that a lot of people don't like to be alone, afraid to be alone. I think it's a death thing. A lot of people are frightened at night time, to wait during the night.
My radio is on all night. That's my night light, and I admit it, it is never off.
These are things
that's on,
you have to be careful of, that you're not blocking out what you're afraid of, and that maybe that one is afraid of also thing. So I think in that sense, you have to be careful. I'm not sure, Constantine, maybe you can help more, but that you may not be, some people may not be using those things as a clinging.
No, but I'm thinking of a productive, giving person who likes to experience many things.
Constantine's point is that, as we've said before, we're all different. We all have different interests.
Of course.
Some people are very sociable. Some people like to be on their own. Some people like to go this way. Some like to go that. It doesn't matter at all. It just depends on our individual accumulations. And if we're talking about developing more understanding, it doesn't have anything to do with changing our life. It doesn't mean that if you're a busy, wealthy businessman, you suddenly stop being a busy, wealthy businessman, or if you're a quiet, isolated housewife, you suddenly become a... It doesn't have anything to do with that, because these are dependent on conditions and our tendencies. But it means that whatever one's life, whatever one's interest, whatever one's involvement, that one begins to understand one's life better, and by understanding realities, one clings less to the idea of someone or something, the
that is doing all these things. But, you know, sometimes people have the idea that, oh, by developing more wisdom, it means that, oh, suddenly they're not going to be able to spend so much time with their family, or they should go off to live in a monastery, or... But this is not what you're saying at all. It's not a matter of changing one's daily life, but of understanding it better.
Yeah, of course.
I'd like to attempt an answer to your question. We take our life as being something over which we have a lot of control. We think we make choices as a result of which various things happen, not always according to the way we predict they will, but more or less we understand that we run our life and we have that control and our relations with other people. Now, one is told that, in fact, that is not the case, that we are an agglomeration of different experiences. We see, we hear, we think, and so forth, and we react to situations as they arise because of our personality, our character, our past experiences, our memory, that in fact there isn't the kind of control that we take there to be in life. If that in fact is what life is like, then it puts a different complexion on it altogether. The only way one can verify it one way or the other is to develop understanding of what is actually happening at the present moment.
Can I ask a question, please? Yeah. Mm-hmm. You mentioned suffering quite a few times. Is there any particular reference, or I'm not trying to draw into the personal side of things, but like people use that word, a certain direct relationship experience, or even a certain belief in that life cycle or the path that you walk on? Is there any reason why you use that word? It's a matter of curiosity and interest, that's all.
Well, it's just that I think suffering is something, I suppose, that must interest all of us insofar as we're exposed to it.
Yeah, right.
And suffering can come about through very personal experience, or one can read about it. It can come a physical, mental experience, or it can be some form of physical suffering, a volcano erupting. And one might well ask oneself, well, why does all this take place? Certainly, you know, from a Christian point of view, where God was supposed to have created Earth and created us all, and everything was perfect, and yet it's not perfect, is it? It's far from it. It's a tremendous dilemma for a Christian, isn't coming to terms with suffering. That's a great dilemma. But why, and why should that be? Why should it be that we should be exposed to suffering? And why should we be exposed to unjustified suffering? Where, for instance, we were talking about it earlier, the reckless boss, you know, who fires you, or who makes a decision that has unknown, totally chaotic causes for your own life, to totally ruin you in a matter of minutes. I mean, there's great injustice in that, and it's.
It mightn't be ruin.
No, that's what I was saying myself.
Yeah. You've got no idea what the result will follow.
But the difference is the people in that position, they're very often not able to see that clearly. It can be devastating. And I think the other thing about people in that situation is that feeling of aloneness, that nobody cares. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, you know, everybody gets over it. I think the bulk of people get over it. Some people don't.
It comes also up from the point that I think that we're all, you know, I was saying earlier, we all enjoy the same, wherever we live in the world, we all enjoy the same things. I'm sure we would all like to see our families prosper. We would all like to see our children, if we have any, happily set up, well educated, well established, well cared for. We would all like to care for our friends. We all share that, irrespective in the world where we live. We all experience, to a degree, the same type of suffering. We all, wherever we live, you know, problems with work, problems with one's personal health, And I think it's just that our different cultures have evolved different answers to deal with these issues.
I think you were saying that the world is the same for all of us.
Well, yes.
In one sense that we're all beset by the same problems. This comes back to what we were talking about earlier. And I
don't agree with that.
You don't agree. You contrasted someone who was born into a good family and brought up well, and then someone who's born in Somalia. But someone can be born into one city at the beginning of their life, and then later in life find themselves in the other, the starving, impoverished.
Yes.
Now, the realities that that person experiences haven't changed. He still sees and hears and smells and tastes and touches and thinks.
But there's
a different combination of those experiences. A person who is in a comfortable position can feel hungry. Someone who has an easy life can experience a lot of pain through illness or something like that. So I'm suggesting that the basic experience of life are the same for everyone, but they appear in different combinations. And to some, they all seem to be painful, unpleasant ones. And for others, they might be much more pleasant and comfortable.
Well, I still don't agree with you. I mean, for instance, let us take the experiences of the people, the concentration camp victims, you know, who started out in a healthy, good life, and then they landed either dead without any control over their fate at all. So life had changed radically forever for them.
And they were treated not only, hurt, but taken away their dignity.
And physically destroyed. So I just don't think that we share the same life experiences in general.
Not life experiences, but seeing
is the same, hearing is the same for that person at every stage of their life. Just like hearing is the same for the starving refugee in Somalia, as hearing is the same for you, and seeing is the same.
Well, no, I mean, this starving refugee, he will hear the spider and he will eat that spider. You see, that hearing is food, and I'm listening to the beautiful birds singing. We're not hearing the same things at all. He's alert to anything that crawls and he can eat. So he his hearing is selective, as is mine.
Now, one person hears nature, another hears food, and it's really quite different. It's the same physical reality of the bird, but the hearing process is the same. The object of the hearing is entirely different.
The information is totally different.
So thinking about what is heard is different depending on different experiences and conditioning.
Yes. Sure, processing is totally different. Right.
So how does one enhance one's perception of the absolute reality? Through meditation? Or how does one go about gaining knowledge of that?
It depends on the definition of what you mean by meditation. To me, it means the development of understanding the reality of this moment. Little by little. Because life exists only in a moment, and this moment is so real, next moment hasn't come yet, and the previous one has fallen away. So the reality that can give you the truth and understanding must be this very moment. And if there is the understanding of reality of this moment, it is the development of understanding on and on. So I don't know whether you call this meditation or not. The development of understanding of reality of this moment.
Is there anything to do with we talk about seize the moment? I mean, is there some parallel to it?
All right, everyone sees right now. It depends on whether there is understanding of this moment, or just let it go without any awareness, any understanding of the true nature of seeing, that it's only an element. But it's the element which can experience only visible object. This kind of element cannot hear, it cannot think, it is real because now it arises, so it sees. And if there is understanding of this element as just a moment which is conditioned, and it's common to all who were born, see?
I'd like to ask another question. Is that, you know, when we talk about looking, hearing this particular moment, I mean, this moment in time is so short. How do you, putting down to possibly pathetic, because, you know, your moment is like a second. You see this moment, bang, it's gone. Now, how do you understand that moment within this particular minute?
It arises again, see, but not the previous one.
No, but that's what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. So, it is a continuous motion.
Instead of thinking of the arising and passing away of each one, what about beginning to develop that understanding of seeing, that seeing is a moment which experiences a reality, not you who sees, because we used to think that I see, I hear, I am pleasant, I am unpleasant all the time, but in reality, these are different realities which arise at different times by different conditions.
So what you're saying is you should detach yourself and see possibly from top to say, hey, this is the moment in time, the life passage that we got to be joining with
when
this particular moment.
When one tries to do something, one cannot escape from the idea of self or I'm trying. That is not the development of understanding, because it's I who's trying. With the idea of I, okay, it's impossible to eradicate the self or the I.
Okay. In that case, if following from your argument, is that if you have the I, then I agree with you, because you've got to have that motive to drive you to try. But on the other hand, if you don't try, you'll never reach that moment.
You don't have to try. It's like you don't have to try to see, you don't have to try to hear. When there are conditions for hearing, must arise. So when there are conditions right enough for awareness and understanding reality, it arises.
Okay, may I ask then, what are the conditions?
When you haven't heard about absolute reality at all, it's impossible for you to consider it. But when you learn to understand the meaning of absolute reality, then it can condition moments of thinking or considering of absolute reality now, whether it's absolute reality or whether it's you. Because when we talk about the world situation of Somalia, starvation, all that, it shows that nothing can be controlled at all. You cannot do anything. You cannot control life in Somalia or here in Hong Kong, because each moment is conditioned to be like that. But one can learn to understand reality, which is already arisen by conditions as different realities.
I would say that, you know, I would try to understand my perception of trying to understand the conditions of Somalia, how it happened. I would also argue that I would try to improve the conditions of my life. What I'm basically saying is, if I have not generate this particular motion to say, I try to gain an understanding.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, your argument would be, or your statement would be, you don't have to try, it comes to you. When the moment is right, when the understanding is correct, when the conditionals are there, and you don't even have to try, you know, it's there with you. But without trying, it is, I go with the situation, sorry to, to argue, but without trying, without setting a certain objective, like from my staff, hey guys, you know, you've got to do that much, and my staff would say, hey, it come, and I would say, hang on, it won't come, you don't go and try, go and get it.
Mm-hmm.
Right, I mean, the conditions are not right.
That.
I've got to create my own conditions
that. But when you understand that effort is a reality, not you or anything. Effort is real,
yeah.
Intention is real, volition is real. Mm. What you say in daily life are all real. So when you understand that they are different realities, so whenever any kind of it arises, you recognize or you understand that, oh, it's that reality that we used to take for I have volition or intention to such and such, but actually it's only different kinds of intention or volition. Mm-hmm. So volition is real, effort is real, but not you. Understand this, and then you understand that why do you like to be so much better than this in all aspects, but it's impossible because it depends on conditions beyond control. But right understanding can develop from this moment.
If these conditions are beyond control, how do they arise?
By conditions, like hearing. No matter you wish to hear something, but when there's not right conditions for its arising, it's
like conditions in Somalia or
everywhere, every moment of reality, it cannot just arise by accident or by will, but it depends on conditions like fire and the extinction of fire.
So if we see the value, if we see the value in something, like generosity or patience or whatever, then that's a condition for there to be more of that good quality arising. If we just wanted to have more, that would not be a condition for there to be, for us to be more patient or generous to other people. But if we considered the usefulness of those qualities and how they benefit others and ourselves and so on and so forth, and look for opportunities, then so I think seeing the value in something is one of the conditions, and thinking about it. Same with understanding.
Seeing the value in something, then, you know, then you have to go for it. but this is it.
Conditions.
Yeah. But whether or not it's you, whether or not it's your emotion within you, you can say, well, that's only my emotion. It's not really me. Okay, but, you know, seeing the value in there, you actually, you know, I mean, there's a saying, is a Chinese saying, if you want to pick up that gold, you know, that gold on the floor, you got to pick it up. That's an effort. But what I'm saying is, if you're seeing a value in it, you actually go to get it, and in between there is a certain effort that's required. So there is that moment in time that you really have to generate enough effort and conditions in the right moment to achieve that. I'm arguing. I've lost my mind. Please help.
Even while you are doing it, so it's not you. Until the right understanding is fully developed, until it can eradicate the idea of self completely, absolutely, permanently. Otherwise, there must be the idea of self or the clinging to the self very deeply rooted.
Right. So I tell my staff, whatever I work so hard is not for me.
Yes. Yes. Why not? But in what sense? Absolute sense or conventional?
I would say it's a conventional sense. Conventional sense. But I mean, in a sense, it's true. That, I mean, I work, sorry, I'm only saying I in a small way, but it's an experience. You know, you work so hard to, it's part of me that I work very hard. So you can say that it's conventional or conditional.
Excuse me when you say part of me.
It's my nature. So whether or not it's just
I. Not just part.
Not just part, okay. It's just me.
You take that reality for you.
Yeah, it's my conditions or my perception of myself.
Yes, yes.
Maybe that's not an understanding of myself, but I always take it that for me to work hard, it's me. It is kind of my reality that I may have to accept. So I drive my staff to work hard. It may or may not agree with me because it may not be part of their nature to work hard. So by myself working hard, I kind of try to motivate them to work hard to achieve a common goal. Now, the point I'm trying to get is, if I totally devote myself to work and forget it about the capital I, so to speak, that is part of the analogies that you try to use. Is that correct? Or please correct me. I'm losing here.
What's your question?
Well, the question...
What you're saying is at those times when you forget about yourself, is that understanding, not self. It doesn't mean that there's any understanding at those times. It just means that there are conditions for thinking about this set of objects and not that set of objects.
Yeah, but it's a small analogy of detaching yourself.
Because you're lost in your work.
Well, it's not the word lost, it's totally devoted,
totally
irrespective, wrong. You know, your life or death, in a sense.
It's your reality.
It's my perceived reality, yeah, so to speak.
But we could say that for all of us, whatever our lifestyle or work or whatever, at different times in the day, there are conditions to think about different things.
Mm.
So maybe there are conditions to think about this project at this time or thinking about these students or whatever it is. So these are different stories that we think about all in a day, but that is different from understanding and development of detachment from realities. And you said, well, what can you do? Well, for example, sitting here listening, considering about these realities like seeing a visible object, maybe you've never heard this kind of consideration before, but hearing it will be, may or may not be a condition for more considering in the future, maybe just on an intellectual level in the beginning. So listening to these things now, this is a condition for a certain kind of considering in the future. Now, if you say, okay, well, tomorrow from 9 o'clock to 10 o'clock, I'm going to think about these things, it may or may not happen because it's impossible to control the thoughts of intellectually, and because it's only intellectually in the beginning, that's why there are a lot of conditions for doubts and uncertainties or whatever. But if one begins to understand a little bit in theory in the beginning, the difference between absolute realities and conventional realities, that is a condition for a deeper understanding by direct experience to develop. So the conditions for deeper understanding to develop are not I deciding I'm going to take the three steps and to grab it, but hearing, considering, thinking. But it's not I that is hearing at this moment. There are conditions for hearing to hear, and then for thinking to hear about it. For convenience, we can say it was me sitting here listening, but this is just the concept, the idea we have.
People are the same, seeing, hearing, and thinking. But what one thing is different from the other is different explanation of thinking about. She thinks about that, and but it's only a moment of thinking. And one can understand the difference between the world of absolute reality and the world of conventional.
Mm.
In one's life.
Yeah, I think this is to get a clearer picture of what you were saying, the conventional reality and the conditional. Once you have that framework, I suppose, again, you shouldn't really restrict yourself to a certain framework. But then again, that to reach that reality is so difficult.
It's like learning to read and write or any kind of subject. It needs time to understand little by little. For example, when we understand that what the world comprises only six doorways, like seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and thinking, no matter what the thought is about. So it's all that. So when there is a moment of experiencing hardness without thinking, you know that that is the world of reality, absolute reality, because we don't have to name or call it at its hardness or its table. It has its own characteristic that can be experienced directly. And nobody can create this at all, and nobody cannot stop it from passing away. But right understanding hasn't develop to the degree that it can experience the arising and following of practice here, because we used to think that it's there all the time. But if it does not arise, even you think that it's there, there is no hardness to be experienced.
Mm.
See? So then, but when there is thinking, you know that that is conventional world again. Mm. So in one's life, there are both the world of absolute truth and conventional truth.
At the same time, with the conventional world, we here, by and large, have to adhere to this conventional world to a degree. Do we not? I mean, we all here to a certain extent work for a living.
Mm-hmm.
So by and large, we have to pretty much work with that framework. Then after that, things may be different.
But we cannot just think about realities by oneself, because it's beyond our thought.
Sure.
But when we read and study and consider, we can understand more about absolute realities.
But I think that seeing more clearly that there is a conventional side and an absolute side to the world doesn't mean that we stop living the conventional side. It just means that we understand it more clearly. One is not trying to change that in any sense.
Sure. I think that's something that one has to understand that before one reaches another, therefore to understand the absolute reality. Because we're always bombarded by this conventional reality as such, then we do not really spend a lot of time on this absolute reality or understanding, so to speak.
By understanding the absolute reality, the whole will reduce into just one moment. And then you know that how it arises in process, succession in a day, from one doorway to another doorway with thoughts in between. That can be directly experienced, to, like seeing is not hearing, and seeing is the element that can experience an object. See? Not anyone. Nobody. And nobody can control the arising of each moment, because there are conditions for its arising. To like or dislike cannot be controlled.
Mm. Would you say the passage of moment is pretty much the absolute reality, because it's definite?
Sorry, when you say the passage of moment,
or that moment there in time.
Mm-hmm.
So you're really talking about a whole series of moments, which are, as you said, they're separate. A whole series.
I see.
Passage is a whole series of moments.
See.
Passage is like a...
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Let's say it started from the moment of birth, right? Because when we say that someone is born in the womb, not later, it means that there must be consciousness, the element which can experience an object arising with a group of rupa, or corporeality, or materiality. Or,
materiality.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That cannot be seen yet, because it's so very tiny, like atom at that moment, before there are conditions for its growth, until there are senses like eyes, sense and ears, and so on. Mm. And when one says that one dies, it means that the consciousness stops its arising, and it deprives one from this world, or I don't know what to explain.
Removes one.
But there are conditions for the arising of another being, and one forgets about the previous life, like now. We forget about many things, even when we were young, not previous life, but one can see that nothing can stay, and even thinking on memory arises with it, citta. And so it's only conventional death, when we use the term death. because now it arises and falls away. So we are not afraid of losing anything because we are losing all the time.
Sure.
Yeah.
It makes you a loser, doesn't it?
I just want to get an answer to the question why there's so much injustice and inequality in mankind. Say, for the baby who born in Somalia, and baby who born some with a silver spoon in his mouth. When I was trying to attempt an answer to this, if I am correct about my belief of Buddhism, I think the answer seems to lie to the fact that if someone is being, doing some sinful act, then the sort of things will carry through to maybe partly in his life he got some retribution, and also sometimes sort of the term is karma, is that so? You got a second life which pays back for the sin that you did commit in your previous life. So maybe that explains why some people are having sort of miserable life. Is that true, that this is the understanding of the Buddhism, that their previous life have done something sinful?
Yes.
So that is to pay pay for the reward or pay for the sin that previous life has done.
We can say
that
again.
That explains why in this life these people are having this sort of suffering.
What we use the word last life or previous life is only conventional. What about previous moment? Can we say that it's like previous life? Because it's completely gone. But it's not the final end of this span of life yet. So we say that this is not death yet. So what you say for previous life is the last moment of consciousness of previous life, which is followed by the next moment, which is the birth of this life. And when we think about one's deeds in a day or in a year, we do not have only good deeds and we do not have only bad deeds, right? But citta or consciousness arises only one at a time. So when the citta, this moment has fallen away, it conditions the next moment, right? So the next moment of citta has all accumulations from the previous one, and it goes on or keeps on like this. That's why it seems like we are one personality, one being, but actually the citta arises from moment to moment. And since the previous one conditions the next one carries. Or what you say, Jonathan, please help me to explain this.
The accumulations are carried from one moment of consciousness into the next, as each one is succeeded by another moment of consciousness. The accumulations of the previous moment are passed on.
Yes, but someone might not like the word pass on or carried on or things like that, because it seems like there's something. So what about since this one conditioned the next one, like the mango seed, when it's planted, then the mango tree grows, and it cannot change into durian or other kind of fruit. See, it's like one moment of citta conditioned the next moment. It carries.
Right.
By condition.
Because that, to me, suggests that from growth, things are getting bigger. It's growing bigger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yet, with each moment, some of our moments are more noble or better than other moments.
Mm-hmm. Right.
How would... Because one would hope that you would learn from your moments, and each moment would be progressively more enlightened, perhaps. But it doesn't seem to work like that.
Mm-hmm. Because we don't understand our own accumulation precisely yet. We just assume that we have everything. Some are wholesome and some are unwholesome. But if we understand more precise about this very moment, and it keeps on understanding the other moment, then one can understand one's own accumulation better and better.
I see. So that perhaps by the time of death, in terms of final death, in this body, perhaps the accumulation will, you will perhaps learn something from it, or your final moment may be, if that's what you want,
it depends.
Your final moment may be the most enlightened of your life with this particular body.
But it depends on daily life, like today, how many moments of wholesomeness and how many moments of unwholesomeness. When one is so honest, one knows that when there's clinging, it cannot be considered as wholesome, because clinging is not wholesome at all, no matter what degree. So in the day, there are moments of unwholesomeness, of ignorance. And in order to develop wholesomeness, one thing that is the great thing is developing understanding. Because if you develop wholesomeness like kindness, generosity, but it cannot eradicate the idea of self, the ignorance of not understanding reality as it is, because there must be the idea of self very deeply rooted all the time, no matter how good you are or how much wholesomeness you have done.
Yeah. Then perhaps I think something else in terms of
we cannot control our unwholesomeness or wholesomeness, because when there are right conditions for unwholesomeness, it does arise. No, body can stop. Like singing, you cannot stop singing because it has arisen already. Each moment is conditioned to arise. We cannot stop it. But there can be understanding from now on with awareness and right understanding. For example, when we talk about seeing, we are talking about the story of seeing. There is not the understanding of the actual seeing as just a reality which is experiencing visible object, right? We just talk about seeing is not self, it's not I who see, and it needs eye sense and visible object, and seeing is different from visible object. This is all the story of reality, while the reality itself is now performing its function from moment to moment. Like seeing cannot feel, it cannot be pleasant or unpleasant, because it can perform the function of seeing only. Each reality has its own function, its own characteristic. So when there is understanding of its characteristic and its function more, it will lessen the idea of self, but only at level of thinking, not at level of directly experiencing yet. So right understanding has to grow little by little with the development of hearing, considering about what one has heard, and reality appears all the time without understanding. So now one begins to understand when there is awareness of what one has heard, and the characteristic of reality appears like now, sound appear, or visible object appear, or hardness appear. They are all realities that can give us more truth about non-self and uncontrollable realities.
I'm not sure what you had in mind when you said that we don't learn more from our...
We don't seem to.
Right.
I mean, I don't know whether we do or we don't, but we...
For it,
but,
can you just give an example?
Well, sometimes our actions, and our actions may be as a result of our past experience or some exogenous influence that's appeared, but our actions sometimes belie what we have learnt.
Right.
I mean, our actions may become ungenerous or harmful when we know that they shouldn't be,
right,
for example.
Could we say that we have so many different tendencies accumulated, so maybe there is some accumulated generosity, but there's also a lot of accumulated stinginess, so even though we know that the thing to do is a generous thing, because the stinginess is so strongly accumulated, even though we may have the intention to give, but when we come to the act, we hold back because the what we call the defilements are so strongly accumulated, the clinging to oneself is so strong that...
Or if we say, I'm not going to let that upset me again, but still it does.
Mm. Or well, then people who have become violent, or perhaps who have experienced, like Barbara was talking about, the abused child then becomes an abuser themselves, yet they haven't learned from that experience. That's what I meant. But one makes me wonder if it can be likened to a mango seed growing into a mango tree. I think you were, the point you were making, that you, it wouldn't grow into a durian tree, it'll grow into a mango tree. But I'm wondering, sometimes it doesn't seem to grow at all. It may grow strangely, or partly grow, or...
By conditions.
Mm-hmm.
You could say there are also a lot of weeds growing in between the mango tree as well.
I think I got a bit lost in my question there.
But also, maybe the reason we don't learn more from our experience is that we don't fully understand. And it comes back to a proper understanding of the present moment and how we perceive life. Because if, as I say, if we think that we are in control and that we should be able to act or react in the way that we know deep down we ought to do, but we find that we can't, and then obviously it shows that we aren't in control in the way that we perhaps think we are. So obviously there's something that we don't understand about our life or the world as it is.
Well, we're not really in control anyway, are we?
It seems like there is the self who can do many things, but when there is the full understanding of reality, one knows that no self at all who can do anything, because there is no self.
I think we think we are in control.
Yes.
And I think we assume the same to other people. Because if someone behaves badly towards us...
Yes, we think that that was a controlled reaction.
We think it was a controlled reaction.
Yeah.
And we react in that sense. Mm. As if, but even if we say that we know we're not in control because we can understand that intellectually, yet still we do not and cannot lead our lives as though we really understood that, and so that it was no longer a factor in our life.
Well, I guess that we are brought up by being not in control is very different from being out of control.
That's
in a sense.
That's right.
But we are brought up needing to feel that we are very much in control, usually in a conventional sense.
Danny, you're not, though. I mean, the minute you're born, you're actually not in control. In a conventional sense, because you're pretty much under the control of the parents and the conditions. You know, maybe after some 20-odd years, you got a job and you think, in the conventional sense, that you think your life can be controlled. You're your own destiny.
Well,
I mean,
you're
taught a lot of people.
From being a child, your parents are teaching you to be in control. I mean, there's toilet training, and that's all about control, down to the basic level. But that's kind of learning to control yourself in the dinner table, and, you know, going on from there. So I think that we are taught to be in control as we grow up, even though we may not be.
And when we come back to the six doorways, we know that it's only thinking, because after seeing, hearing, there is thinking about manners, etiquettes, and things like that. So life is only six doorways in reality.
So even at the moment of thinking that I'm in control of the situation and I can organize my work, it's just a moment of thinking only. It's just a concept for a moment, and who knows about this moment. Sure.
Because then maybe our condition sets in.
Exactly. You can say, okay, well, I'm going to
step this way and then sure. something happens, there's a typhoon, you step that way. I mean, it's...
Sure.
So it's just a story, it's just an idea.
The six-door concept is very interesting about, I mean, you're referring that as the sixth sense.
The sixth one.
Mm. The
six doors.
The six doorways. Yes, very interesting, because this is life. Mm-hmm. We don't miss anyone. We all have six, when we have eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body.
Mm. And to have all the doors open is to have the understanding of the moment.
Considering even when, like Neil was saying, someone is so frightened of death and there's so much clinging, but really when it comes down to it, even if we so much want to get rid of this fear or whatever, that people don't really want to give up their clinging and they don't really want to give up the idea of self, do they? So it's like one wants to get rid of something, but one doesn't really want to. Most of us, most of the time, we're not really brave enough to really accept or get rid of the idea of self, because it's like we're so afraid of death, but we're even more frightened to get rid of the idea of self, and for people to understand that stories or concepts are only concepts. This is very threatening, isn't it? I mean, people get quite upset about it.
Out of ignorance, one is so afraid to experience reality directly of its arising and falling away. It seems like it's very appealing because it's so true that seeing cannot stay, hearing cannot stay, thinking cannot stay. But even so, are we ready to experience that moment, which there is nothing except one moment of experiencing arising and falling away? See? So frightening when it's not the fully developed right understanding.
Why is it so frightening?
Because if one just wants to, it's not with right understanding at all. But when right understanding grows, and at the moment that when right understanding is not developed enough to that degree, then it's clinging. Because clinging always follows every moment, everywhere, not wanting to lose. That moment of seeing, that moment of hearing.
And is it just because of, you know, such strong clinging to our stories that we have that...
And also to realities, not only story, see?
Well, I suppose it's also the clinging and the wrong view of self that makes it... People don't want to accept that the stories are only stories. And
yes, because clinging and ignorance doesn't let go to the development of right understanding, because it clings so much about the story, the idea of self.
You must have a certain level of clinging, you know.
Right, because there are many levels, like clinging to sensuous object is different from clinging to the idea of self.
Mm.
So in order to get rid of clinging, it's impossible to just go straight to get rid of the clinging to sensuous object, because there must be the eradication of the idea of self first. Because even there is no idea of self, there still is clinging to sensuous object, and one realizes that it's only a reality. And since there are still conditions for its arising, there must be clinging to sensuous object until right understanding develop higher. So that one can see the danger, the useless of sensuous object, because it's exactly the same, no matter it's pleasant or unpleasant. It can be experienced, that's all. And it arises and falls away so fast that there is nothing in it. Even it's pleasant, it's just for a split second. And one can estimate how much ignorance one has in one's life, because those who had become enlightened as an arahata, after seeing, there's no defilement at all. So before having no defilement, there must be right understanding followed seeing first, so that there cannot be defilement at all later. So this is the difference between those who do not hear about absolute reality. There is no awareness, no development of understanding of reality which appears. But those who have heard and have well established of the understanding of the reality, even intellectually, there are conditions for another level of understanding to develop by direct awareness of the characteristic of reality which appears. So many realities now, but there is no direct awareness of anyone yet, because we are talking about their stories. So it takes time to develop.
It takes a long time, doesn't it?
Long, long time.
A lot of corrections and
thinking about the previous ignorance, not only in this life.
Is the idea of not self, is that difficult for you to consider, or is it something you've considered before anyway?
It's certainly something that I would have read about and considered, yeah.
But some words can be misleading, like suffering. Something that is only a pleasant feeling, which is suffering, but in reality it means the arising and falling away is the real, is that characteristic which is not satisfactory at all, because it cannot stay as you think or as you like it to be.
Again, you probably don't have any control.
Right.
Some people say, like Neil said, and I think Jan said, how to get rid of suffering, but what they mean is how to get rid of the unpleasant things in life, really. And the answer is impossible to avoid unpleasant experiences, but possible to develop understanding. But ultimately, because each reality, each moment arises and passes away, each moment is ultimately unsatisfactory. I mean, this is the meaning of suffering, not just the things we don't like. It's clinging to the things we like that causes what we call the suffering.
That's true.
I mean, the more you segregate a line between like and dislike, then, you know, the more you're drawn to like, and then the more...
That's right, the more dislike there's going to be.
So, from time to time, I take it you've got to be passive. Maybe even... I don't know the solution, I mean...
Well, I think, again, it comes down to understanding, because we can say, OK, well, I'm going to this Chinese banquet and I'm going to be passive. Who can control it? It's conditioned, you know, the attachment is conditioned. So the answer is not to avoid the Chinese banquet, and the answer is not to have no attachment, but the answer is to understand, OK, just a moment of attachment, but this is the reality at that moment. So it's not a matter of being afraid of one's unwholesomeness or trying to get rid of one's unwholesomeness, but just understanding it as it is.
Yeah. Or accepting it.
Accepting and understanding, exactly.
And when great understanding develops on and on, one begins to understand that one lives just alone.
Mm-hmm.
At moment of seeing, one is alone with visible object. At moment of hearing, one is alone with sound. At moment of thinking, one is alone with one's own thought.
Mm.
Thinking of different things at moment of seeing or hearing, or even there is no seeing, no hearing, there is still thinking. So one just lives alone, but one thinks that one lives with many people in the world, but it's only thinking.
So true.
One lives alone with the moment of seeing, whether it's here or Somalia or it's Richard Pawnee. And
Buddha knew that it's impossible to solve the world's problem as long as there is still ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why he helped the others by teaching about realities.
Mm-hmm.
Because even you are not a Somalian, there can be unpleasant feeling when you have everything in life. As long as there is defilement, there cannot be the tranquility or calmness, because you still don't let go the idea of mine or I.
Yeah.